So my name's Tasha Williford. I work with the Ohio Ministry Network out of their regional campus, Southeastern University. I'm the student life director there. So I get to work with college students every day, but I also on part-time do counseling. So I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor and marriage and family therapist. And most of my work has been with teenagers in the partial hospitalization setting, so a step-down unit from the inpatient psychiatry unit, but not quite ready to go back to school. So that's been most of my professional experience, so we might be touching on some of those things today. But if you have any questions during the this session, feel free to like just jump in right away. We don't have to wait till the end, because if you're like me, you'll forget by the end of my presentation. So just raise your hand. We'll do it. All right. So if you came in late, we can send the fidget box around again if you need it. My friend Nicole will help you out with that. But like I said, if you need to fidget, stand up, take breaks, that's totally fine. But what I wanted to do today in terms of trauma-informed ministry, because I know that's what we are here for, I did want to briefly touch on the subject of trauma. And I thought the best way to do that was this illustration I found in this book. Has anybody seen this book before, heard of it? Trauma-Informed Pastoral Care. Okay, if you ignore everything else that I say today, get this book, it's super helpful. Okay, so Trauma-Informed Pastoral Care by Karen McClintock. Very, very helpful. I pulled a lot of stuff from the this presentation today as relates to ministry. So again, if you don't hear anything else I say, buy the book, okay? But let's use her illustration as a context for the topic of trauma. So she talks about, she was on a tour with Southern Oregon Land Conservancy. A small group of hikers went up to a high valley along the Cascade Mountain Range one early June. With permission from the landowners whose property they traversed, they followed a wooded path to the edge of an open meadow. Their guide stopped the group and asked them to describe what they saw before them. It was an expansive vista of late spring wildflowers, butterfly-loving milkweed, yellow mule's ears, purple native iris, tall grasses quivering in a light breeze, and a flyover by a red-winged blackbird. The guide smiled and urged the group forward. What happened next unnerved them. They stepped from volcanic rock and hard-packed dirt onto a spongy surface of rare 40-acre wetland that felt like an extra firm waterbed. With each step, they felt the ground give slightly, and though it held them up, they could see undulating ripples flow away from them in the vegetation. At first, they all instinctively froze in place and became silent. They'd been on board boats listening from side to side, but this was much less solid. They were walking on a meadow fed by mineral-rich springs covered over by several feet of matted vegetation. Life was growing beneath the surface that couldn't have survived above the ground. With each sloshy step, they couldn't be sure if the surface would hold or if their feet would plunge into water. It was unlike anything they had ever experienced. While the ground looked solid, it wasn't. The hikers found it confusing at first, and they had to slow down to let their bodies rebalance and then make adjustments. It was truly a hike unlike any they had ever taken. A walk through the quaking fin is an apt description of life after trauma. Things may look normal, but definitely are not. Solid ground gives way, replaced by an emotionally unstable landscape. There's a lot going on under the surface. So we're going to talk today about how to best care for people who might have a lot going on under the surface, or those who might be finding some new balance on a new unstable landscape. But before we jump into that, I thought it'd be helpful to, again, do a brief discussion on what trauma really is. So according to SAMHSA, individual trauma results from an event, series of events, or a set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or threatening, and that has lasting adverse effects on the individual's functioning and physical, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being. So even an unreligious organization notices that trauma can in fact impact their spiritual well-being. Vincent Folletti describes this event as the three E's. So the event impacts the experience of those events and the long-lasting effect of adverse effects of the event. It's highly individualized, so what you may consider trauma may not be trauma for the person sitting next to you. And especially as it relates to kids, what we think might be trauma may not be traumatic to them, and vice versa. So think of like a pet dying. That's going to be highly traumatic for a child, but may not be as traumatic for you. Of course, it may hurt and things like that, but what they see as trauma is going to be very, very different from what we see. I've noticed that just recently, my family was in a car accident in the fall, and so all of us engaged with that very, very differently, okay? So for me, I'm from Kansas, so I've been driving for a really, really long time, legally and illegally. So I've been legally driving since I was 14, and my junior year of high school, I was driving home from youth group, and it was just my sister and I, and we happened to be following somebody who was unlicensed, and we were going through a left turn, no other cars around, but it was a fast intersection, so I kept going, following, and then he slammed on his brakes suddenly, and it caused the airbags to go off in my car. And of course, we were safe, everything. It was the middle of winter, so we all had on puffer jackets and things like that. But the impact of the airbags was strong enough that both of us had bruises from our seat belts, even with all the layers that we had on. And so follow that to a couple of years later, several years later, when we were church planting in Cincinnati, I had just gotten my oil changed in my car, and I'm driving down 75, and all of a sudden I see smoke coming out of my engine. And so I pull over to the side, and the flames are getting higher. It was kind of cartoon-like, honestly. And so I just get out of the car, and my first call is to my husband, Josh, just to let him know I'm walking down the highway on 75, my car's on fire, and he's like, great, call 911. So I did, obviously, later. So I go from my junior year car accident that triggers airbags, which if you've ever experienced that, the power of the airbag going off does create like a smoke smell, kind of like a gunshot, you know? And then I have a car fire, so then I smell fire, right? And then fast forward a couple years later, we're coming home from Kansas with my oldest son Chandler's baby shower. And don't know what happened with that other than I think at one point Toyota had it against me. But on the way home, coming back to Cincinnati, we were about an hour outside of Cincinnati, and the car on the highway just loses power. Josh pulls over, flames out, right? And so the car just burns down to the frame, right? And that is a glorious sight at night because it's pitch black and we're on the highway and all you can see is flames, okay? But it does create something. If you've had multiple experiences, especially as it relates to smell, which is a very, very powerful trigger. And so now fast forward to this year, we have a car wreck and you know the engine starts to smoke. So immediately I become very aware of what's going on inside me because I've had the training, right? So I notice, okay, my heart starts starting to race. I need to do what I need to do to calm down because I know the smoke smell is bothering me and get my kids out of the car. And of course, Josh is going to find the person that drove off that we ran into. So he's doing his thing, Police Officer Williford. And I'm getting my boys because we were about a mile away from church and stuff, just trying to help them recognizing that that's a pretty significant incident for them. So Josh, of course, goes into fight mode or addressing the situation mode. I go into addressing my kids' situation mode, which is very much flight and scared and freeze, so let's get out of the car, right? But even the after effects after that, luckily they were already connected to resources and processing that, but that's just one example of how one incident can impact us all very, very differently, right? And so being mindful of that, whatever ministry you're in, whatever organization you serve, a trauma is very, very individualized for one. Even diagnostically, how we approach it is different for every person, and it's very, very different for a child, depending on where they're at in age and stage of life, or a teenager, as to how an adult may respond to that trauma as well. All right. So how we navigate and understand trauma best is usually with a questionnaire like what we call the ACEs, which is the Adverse Childhood Experience Study. Has anybody heard of that? Okay, so a couple people, you guys cool if I go ahead and explain it? Okay, so what the ACEs is, is it came from Vincent Folletti. He and his study research team developed this questionnaire, and they did an in-depth study around 1995 to 1997, where they wanted to see the impact of traumatic events experienced as a child through adulthood. So they had this questionnaire given at physicals for adults that covered initially 10 topics. So the initial ACEs study just covered these 10 topics, which obviously you can see: physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect, living with somebody with a diagnosed mental illness or who has depression or has been suicidal. If that is somebody in the home, they would identify that as a traumatic experience. Living with somebody who has an addiction to substances or alcohol, witnessing domestic violence at the time, that was mainly as it occurred to mother, but of course that is expanded now to anybody else in the family. Loss of a parent or death from death or to abandonment, and then incarceration of a family member. So those were the initial 10, and that has been expanded now. Most research would now include things like systemic racism. This obviously happened before 9/11, so we're seeing more of that. Anybody who's experienced any sort of war or terrorism or immigration from another country, those who have been involved in any sort of sex trafficking, and then COVID has also been added to that list. Some research would say that COVID for this generation was the 9/11 of previous generations, to the level of that traumatic experience. So what this does is gives us a gauge for how, if especially if untreated, how it's going to impact adults. And even when we actually use this questionnaire working in the hospital, and we could tell usually if they had a score of 4 or higher, it was likely that they could have the diagnosis of PTSD. But it also helped us gauge what type of response they might have to the treatment we were giving them. But what this study also found for adults especially is if a child experienced a score of 4 or more ACEs by the time they were adults, they were 10 to 12 times more likely to use intravenous drugs and attempt suicide. They were 2 to 3 times more likely to have heart disease and cancer, and they were 32 times more likely to have learning and behavioral problems. So that alone, any of my kids' ministry volunteers in the room should tell you that if you have a highly behavioral child in your ministry, there's probably a high likelihood that they might have some trauma in their background. So often trauma can present itself, especially in kids, as ADHD or ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder, and sometimes even autism, because a lot of those diagnoses overlap, but a lot of times there's trauma in their background too. There are additional stats that the ACEs came out with as it pertains to adults, especially if they didn't receive some treatment as a child. So they were 4 times more likely to become an alcoholic. Another research done by Palmer said that they were 15 times more likely to attempt suicide at least once. They were 4 times more likely to develop a sexually transmitted disease, 3 times more likely to use antidepressants, 3 times more likely to be regularly absent from work, which led to 3 times more likely to have serious job problems, 2.5 times more likely to smoke, 2 times more likely to develop chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and 2 times more likely to have serious financial problems. Oh, and saying serious turned on my Siri, sorry. All right. So obviously there's a long list that I've already shown you as it relates to things that can be traumatic, and that's just the list that they're using for their questionnaire. Again, recognizing that it's highly individualized and highly subjective, there are tons more ways that we can experience trauma. But for the purpose of the research that's coming up with these type of statistics, those would be the ones that they are using. So then the factors that impact the trauma, so say they experienced even one of those, there are factors that help determine how they will approach or navigate that trauma. And some of those things would be history of previous trauma. So think through even the brief example I gave. How I responded now was impacted by the other times that I had experienced something similar, right? And so any history of previous trauma might make the experience even more likely to lead to something like a PTSD diagnosis or other mental health concerns such as depression, anxiety, any history of mental health problems, that's gonna potentially exacerbate that. So say somebody had like some low baseline anxiety, if they experience some significant trauma, it might push them over into a more extended or extensive anxiety diagnosis. The after effects and proximity to the experience, which means if somebody lives as a significant loved one related to the trauma, that's gonna impact it, as well as say it's kind of secondhand. So say a student knows somebody at the school who may have passed away and stuff, the proximity to that might as well lean into the impact. And then as well as family history of health problems, mental health problems. So that's gonna be more in the biology side of things. So sometimes mental health stuff is biochemical, so it might be genetic and that might contribute to it, but it also might be because their primary supports also have mental health diagnoses. So say I have a significant trauma and I'm trying to navigate that with a parent who also has significant mental health, such as depression, anxiety, how I'm supported in that is also gonna impact how I navigate that or go through that time. So obviously the impact of trauma isn't just physical, okay? But we are gonna talk about some of that, or just not even just emotional. So what happens is a lot of things in the brain that I'm not gonna go into, but basically what happens is we get cortisol running through our body, which is activated when we go into our fight, flight, or freeze, right? And usually that helps us just survive that one incident, okay? So we're in it, we go into fight, flight, or freeze, we eventually come out of it, okay? But then what we have is called chronic trauma. So think of a kid who's living in an abusive home. They're in a constant state of having cortisol pumping through their brain, which then becomes toxic stress, and it can actually change the mapping of their brain, and that's what's impacting their ability to learn, because most of it is happening in our prefrontal cortex, and we'll talk about that in a second. So what can happen is obviously we go into fight, flight, or freeze, and then that triggers things within our body that gets our heart racing, or more rapid breathing. We potentially clench our fists, things like that. And then that's the initial incident, but say then something later down the road triggers us, if we haven't gone through some sort of therapy to address that, it puts us back into that fight, flight, or freeze. So then again, our heart's racing, our breathing speeding up, things like that. And then you have the emotional impacts of it. Obviously, those can send us into things like depression, anxiety, but it's deeper than that. A trauma is a relational wound. It's a break of trust sometimes. It's a breach of safety. And so what can happen is it's not just a physical trauma that happens to us both externally, potentially, and internally, but it's also a break in our relationships where we no longer trust maybe those who we thought were trustworthy before, or we begin to isolate and separate ourselves from the supports, whether intentionally or unintentionally, because we withdraw. And it might also impact us spiritually, because it's changed, again, if it's a relational wound that breaks relationships, breaks trust, it might also change how we view God. It might cause us to question things, or how the church responds to us might make us feel that I'm not worthy to even be loved by God, right? And so there is obviously all three of those impacted by it, the physical, emotional, and spiritual. But going back to the physical, when it comes to, again, all the technical stuff that I'm not gonna get into, that lands in the prefrontal cortex where all that pain is held, which is also the place where our we interpret language and things like that, all the information, that's also where the preacher is trying to get his messages to. So think about a person whose brain has been changed by a traumatic experience, who's sitting in a service, and the message that you're trying to hear, the love of God, the gospel, can't even get to them because there's pain there. Okay? So we have to figure out how to help them navigate that to where they're hearing the gospel. Because they can't hear the preaching if they're suffering in their pain, because it's in the same space. Okay. I'm not gonna have you raise hands, but going back into the emotional space, what can happen is we can experience things like disassociation because we don't want to remember the event, whether intentionally or unintentionally. We don't want to be around those things. But going back to what it can lead to as far as like withdrawal and things like that, and especially teenagers, when they don't want to feel it, they want to go numb, which means they're going to explore things like substances or self-harm, things like that. And it can almost feel like they've totally changed their personality. Okay, so back it up a little bit further. Think of those kids, and I know you've experienced them. I call them the EGR kids, the extra grace required ones, that are just highly behavioral, and you feel like they're doing it for attention. It's like they're actively trying to have to sit next to me during service, you know? But I think part of it is that trauma. And part of trauma-informed ministry, and we'll get into that, is recognizing that they are doing the best they can with what they have. And this is the coping skills that they know. And it gives you a new grace and a new empathy and understanding for them that is what they're doing to cope. Okay, so they're not doing it to be little stinkers and thinking through those teenagers. Well, sometimes, I mean, they do get benefit from it. They get to sit by me and they get a fidget out of it. I mean, it's basically rewarding them, but, right? But it is, for the most part, doing the best they can. And then thinking through those teenagers who potentially, you think of the ones who are like the bad influences on the group, and they seem like they're doing a lot of attention-seeking behaviors, or again, they might have flipped from being a really, really like good kid to now all of a sudden they're partying and doing all these things. And it might be because something happened to them that they don't trust to tell anybody. I actually already emailed you guys my resource list, but one of the things I found helpful was a podcast on trauma-informed kids ministry, and they were talking through, there was this girl in their youth group, and she had totally changed her personality, acting out, things like that, getting into drugs, sleeping around, things like that. They finally got a trustworthy volunteer that she finally connected with over years in the youth group, and she finally disclosed that an elder in the church had been molesting her. And she, again, was this really, really good kid who had totally changed her behaviors based on an undisclosed trauma. And part of what we'll talk about, trauma-informed ministry, is assuming that most, if not all, the people in your congregation have experienced some form of trauma, which could easily be assumed now with COVID, okay? There was a shutdown, and we have to acknowledge that. So it's pretty easy to assume that at some level, most of the people in your church have experienced at least one form of trauma. Yeah.
A question. This
yeah.
goes back to some of the stats you shared.
Sure.
But you mentioned some of the things like the drug addiction and whatnot. Curious, have they seen that same thing as it relates perhaps to, especially with adults, gambling addictions?
Ooh, good question.
Extreme risk taking where?
Yes.
There's like this addiction
yes.
to like taking extreme risks, is that?
Yeah, so, yeah, I would assume, I mean, I can't speak on the specific stat of gambling addiction, but I do know with a diagnosis of PTSD especially, that increased risk-taking behaviors is a warning sign and a symptom of trauma. So I think it could be safe to assume that that would be one of the things that they would do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With like the cumulative nature of the cumulative nature of this happens once, twice, three times.
Yeah.
As opposed to one specific yep. identifying event.
Yeah.
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 So is this, I guess, now being considered like PTSD, or is there still a distinction between PTSD and CPS?
In the DSM, they'll separate acute stress disorder, or the diagnostic statistic manual. Right now, the DSM-5 is acute stress disorder, PTSD, and then there's ongoing research about like a chronic trauma or complex trauma. So those would be like not single events, like ongoing. With the ACEs, at least the way we did it, we consider it one, but recognizing that obviously being hit one time is a lot different than being chronically abused, right? And so, yeah. But as far as like being trauma-informed, the approach, I don't know that would change. Maybe the referrals that I give might change, if that makes sense. Yeah, good questions. Anything else before we move on? All right. Okay, so going back to the spiritual impact of things and being able to safely assume that most people, if not all people, have experienced some form of trauma, we can go ahead and assume that because the places of worship are a microcosm of society, they are not immune to the pervasive issue of trauma. And one of the things that might be helpful as we go through this next part of the discussion is think through whether your church or organization, where it's located, like even the neighborhood that it's located, like what type of traumas might they be experiencing? Because what the traumas that my church might be experiencing, say, for example, our church is in like downtown Reynoldsburg next to some low-income apartments, might be different than what Radiant Life Dublin might be experiencing. You know what I mean? I mean, it's fair. So like the traumas that they might be experiencing are different. But be thinking of that as we go through this next part of the discussion. Okay, so what does it mean to be trauma-informed? So SAMHSA defines any setting as trauma-informed if the people there realize how widespread trauma is, recognize signs and symptoms, respond by integrating knowledge into practice, and resist doing further harm. Because reality is, the church can be a place of doing further harm unintentionally, but it can happen. One of the ways that we do this is by not acknowledging that the trauma happened. So we have to acknowledge there are some different beliefs, whether it be political, cultural, things like that. Somebody coming into our doors that say they've experienced this kind of trauma. So say somebody came in and they're like, I lost my dad because of COVID. And they happen to be in a church that doesn't believe COVID happened. Well, by telling them that's not true, we've already re-traumatized them. Okay? So we have to be mindful of that. And a trauma-informed ministry would be one that, and it's called a trauma-informed approach, but would be one that would recognize how widespread trauma is, recognize signs and symptoms, respond by integrating principles and practice, and resist doing further harm. So intentionally resisting doing further harm by being mindful of our words and how we approach those conversations, whether we believe, agree, or not, right? And then going back to what I said earlier, I actually pulled this from the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, but a trauma-informed perspective views trauma-related symptoms and behaviors as an individual's best and most resilient attempt to manage or cope. So recognizing that they're doing the best they can, even sometimes if it's doing the best to test my patience, okay? It is. I gotta keep telling myself they're doing the best they can. So again, thinking back to that EGR kid or teenager or even those difficult personality adults, there are just certain personalities that hit you different, and part of it is when we go to not doing further harm, is checking ourselves of why do they bother me so much? There might be something inside of me or some trauma that I have that's actually like projecting onto them, and it might be more about me than about them, right? So we have to be mindful of that too. And part of trauma-informed ministry is recognizing that we need to create an environment that exudes calm, safety, and compassion and make it our goal. Okay, so it was in the definition, but the four R's, according to SAMHSA, of trauma-informed care is realize, recognize, respond, resist. And I can't remember if I told you guys, I sent you my resources page, which is all of the resources that I use particularly for this one. I tried to upload this and technology was against me. I will get it to you or just email me if you specifically want it. But the resource page can be really, really helpful because, again, it has all the podcasts I listen to, all the research articles that I use specifically for this. It has this book. It also has The Body Keeps the Score, which is another really, really helpful book as it relates to trauma and its impact on our body. Okay, so realize the widespread impact of trauma is the first one. So going back to the statistics that we've mentioned a couple times, a score of 4 or higher is going to have 32 times more likely impact on their ability to even learn. So thinking through a kid that we're trying to teach the gospel to, that we're trying to show God's love to, and they are 32 times more likely to have difficulty even learning that. Okay? They are 10 to 12 times at least more likely to use some sort of intravenous drug or attempt suicide. And then 2 to 3 times more likely to have significant physical health issues like heart disease, and then all those other statistics that I shared. And then there's one of the quotes by Bessel van der Kolk, which is "The body keeps the score." But just recognizing that somebody who's experienced significant trauma, even by coming through the doors of our church, is a massive step for them. Their experience might be like walking through a space of just aliens. It's totally different than what they know, because they're not going to trust anybody, because that trust has been broken. So realize the widespread impact of trauma. All right, next one. Recognize the signs and the symptoms. So this is just a really quick flyover of some of the symptoms that might be experienced by somebody who's experienced a traumatic event. So I actually found this really helpful resource. The preschool, elementary, and middle high school chart is from resilientlehighvalley.org. The adult one is just out of the DSM-5. But some of the things, like I said earlier, as it relates to the signs and the symptoms, a preschool child might display symptoms that mirror or match attachment disorders or autism, because you see like fear of separation, immobility, endless motion, troubling, clinging, regressive behaviors are a big one. So think like not sleeping through the night all of a sudden, think bedwetting, things like that. Or they're self-soothing. So self-soothing here would be things like rocking or hitting their heads and things like that. And then going into elementary and middle high school kind of overlap some, so they'll both experience those nightmares and sleep issues. That's where you'll get into those disruptive behaviors, those EGR kiddos, or they might be picking fights or just angry, and they're like, what's going on there? You know, or they might start refusing to go to school. And they also might be displaying those early stage signs of depression, anxiety, or going numb. And then middle high school, they're going to be more likely to avoid reminders of the event, which means they might avoid the places that it occurred. They'll have flashbacks potentially, and they'll also intentionally try to start numbing emotionally through substance use, self-harming, things like that. They might also be more likely to experience suicidal ideation and those antisocial behaviors. That withdrawal piece is really, really big, because again, an early warning sign would be things that a kid maybe used to do because it brought them joy. If all of a sudden they stop, that's a red flag for me. Or another early indicator would be their grades. So if you see grades slipping, teenagers are another one that might display physical symptoms. So they're all of a sudden getting sick all the time, especially if it's school and that's the place where the trauma occurred. That might be another one. And then with the DSM-5 for adults, that's just the general criteria that they would use, that it might they might be experiencing those things. So intrusion would be related to intrusive thoughts, dreams, reminders, flashbacks, things like that. Or they might be disassociating. The avoidance would be avoiding the thoughts related to the event, avoiding the place that it happened, avoiding any triggers related to it. The negative mood and cognition, again, just a general state of negativity, like the world is an unsafe place. Negative thinking, or maybe having distorted memories or fragmented memories of the event. And then changes in arousal and reactivity, that would be those risk-taking behaviors. It could also be related to sleep pattern changes and things like that. But again, some of these could overlap between all of the categories, the preschool one being separate from that. The elementary students, those diagnoses that those usually match most would be some attachment, more ADHD, slight ODD, autism would fall under that it might get potentially misdiagnosed as, and then middle high school, ADHD, ODD, depression, psychosis is another one they would throw in, and potentially borderline personality disorder would be another one that would potentially go there. But somebody have their hand up? Sorry. Okay. seeing things out of the side of my eye.
I do have.
Sure.
I noticed, which category would you list bullying, either in person or social bullying?
Sure.
Tasha, if you can just repeat the question.
Oh. My bad, guys. There was a lot of questions that you missed. Okay, so which category would I put bullying in? So I would say they can experience bullying anywhere in the elementary, middle, and high school, and we do include that in that ACEs study. So if there is some, or that questionnaire, so if they have experienced extensive bullying to the point, especially if they're like avoiding going to school because of it, we would acknowledge that is a trauma for the ACEs. So I apologize, that is one that's potentially been researched and added to those questionnaires as well. Some of the research too, as I was going through this, kind of separated it into capital T trauma and little T trauma, especially as it relates to childhood. So like bullying, they listed that as a little T trauma. Obviously, that's not a little T trauma to somebody who significantly experienced it, but so I don't know that it matters as far as separating that category. Usually in elementary and middle to high school, they could experience it in all of those areas. The other thing to think about too, as it relates to bullying and even some of these trauma symptoms, is think about your sixth graders now who are in youth group. If any of you guys are working with youth, okay, those kids would have been in second grade when it shut down. Going into third grade, if they even started school right away, and think about the stages of development and how not being in school and interacting with anybody socially might have impacted how they navigate these things now or even perceive what is bullying or things like that. Yeah.
So gender identification.
That's a big one.
So I have siblings who are fighting because of that.
Okay.
So what would you do in that case?
What would I personally do in that case? Okay, so what would I do in terms of gender identification? Okay, so what I would do might differ from what you guys do because I do have that that mental health background. That's one of the hats that I wear. It would be different than what I would encourage you guys to do as ministry leaders, okay? So as ministry leaders, I would encourage one, a lot of support and love, because especially a student who may be going through that gender identity, whatever I feel about that, Jesus still loves them, and I can still speak truth and love, but I primarily need to support first, because they're not gonna hear what I have to say as far as what the Bible says about that if I haven't met them where they're at in the lower needs. Okay, so if they don't feel loved and safe and understood, think Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is this triangle, and safety is lower on that. They're not going to hear the higher things about what the gospel says or what the Bible says about what they're doing and thinking about themselves. So I have to meet them lower first. And so for me, I think through things like social supports. What would you do with any siblings in your church, whatever their background is, whatever their gender is, if they were fighting at church? Separate them, right? Keep them in the same space, like don't remove them from the group, but I might not let them hang out together in church, right? Because they're disrupting the whole group. So whatever they're doing, gender identity, things like that, I'm going to treat them the same way in that group, because again, they're not going to hear what I have to say as far as how they feel about themselves, what they believe about themselves, until I've addressed those lower needs, right? So if it's more about them fighting in the group, even about whatever topic it is, I'm going to address the behaviors there first so that they can hear what the rest of the group is talking about. Does that make sense? Counseling, a different approach. I've done things as far as I've done sibling sessions, but most of the time it takes some individual work before I even bring in the second sibling. So, but if it's more of like what's happening at church, I would just treat them the same way I would treat any other sibling that's fighting about those things. But if you have a really good relationship with especially one of them, I would mentor them on the side, you know. Does that answer your question? I don't think it did.
kind of, sort of.
Okay. Yeah. What are your other thoughts on, or what?
The problem is if they come from a supportive family, mm-hmm. if you have a treatment plan or strategy that you want to implement, but you don't get support totally from the parents, then it seems like it's just a ping pong ball going back and forth because you're trying to help them
yeah.
as far as the church is concerned,
yep.
but at home they got another kind of strategy. So.
Oh yeah, it's a very frustrating ping pong game. So thinking through even working at the hospital, I can give the kid all the skills they need, but if we don't address the family, and that's why we do family sessions too when I worked in the hospital, because it's like giving the kid the antidote and then sending them back into a sick home. So the whole family does have to be on board with these things, but it also has to be us doing the best with what God gives us for the time we have and trusting that He's going to handle it when we're not there. And that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of patience and a lot of prayer and managing our own frustrations, because sometimes it is like banging your head against the wall working with families who maybe not might not understand the dynamic at play. Yeah.
Can I say something to maybe help encourage?
Sure.
So the hardest thing for me, because I can feel kind of where he's coming from on some things, is I am not personally responsible for that. And that's one thing that I have taken very hard, because I feel like I can help every kid and I can help every family and I know Jesus, so I have the answer. But I can't make them walk the steps.
Yep.
And that's really hard and that's really frustrating, because you're literally watching them deteriorate.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard to not take that personal, so I really had to develop set of skills to guard my own heart in that. So if that's of any encouragement to you, sir, just to keep loving and keep investing, but make sure you protect yourself and don't in the process too. That could be detrimental to us.
It is. That's good. Yeah. I can't summarize it, but it was really good what she said. They're never going to let me do this again. It's great. You guys know. You know. You heard it. Okay. Which is a good segue into the next one, the R. The R is respond. And so as a trauma-informed church or ministry, it involves more than just strategies for immediate intervention. A trauma-informed ministry responds by fully integrating knowledge and policies and procedures and practice. So what that means is things like intentionally having policies that support the resilience and care of pastoral staff and volunteers who might be navigating these things. So part of a trauma-informed ministry is recognizing that dealing with these difficult topics and these difficult things that our congregants go through might cause some vicarious trauma or burnout, or those feelings of trying to be all things to all people. And so a trauma-informed ministry will actually intentionally have policies and procedures around helping to support the staff by doing things like self-care seminars, or making sure that the pastor is taking and the staff are taking their Sabbath or taking time off, or doing ongoing trainings like watching signs for burnout, and vicarious trauma and things like that. So a trauma-informed ministry intentionally responds by doing that. So thank you guys for that segue into that. That was wonderful. But it also provides safety, choice, collaboration, trustworthiness, and empowerment. So going back to somebody who's experienced trauma, it's that breach of safety, it's that break of trust, it's that breach of relationships, and it's that loss of power. So a trauma-informed ministry is intentionally creating an environment where the person gets to collaborate. So they get to be a part of the discussion. We're creating opportunities that almost bridge that gap of where they feel no one is trustworthy. We prove we are, and we have policies in place that do that. And we give opportunities to empower people. So depending on your relationship with those kids, it might be empowering them to, okay, what do you think needs to happen now? You know, so giving opportunity to that, we also respond by recognizing that there might be a power differential with the people that we minister to. So we recognize that might be an opportunity going into the next one of resisting doing further harm. Recognize that sometimes when we're talking to people, they see us as a person of power. And so we have to recognize that power dynamic because we might be unintentionally traumatizing them. So ideas that I had here in terms of respond, if these things are already going on in your organization, great, but things to maybe consider is talking with your church or organization that you serve at to make sure that they've consulted with insurance in terms of policies and procedures just for general safety, and then even moving forward with other ways that they can be more trauma-informed. So thinking through general things like safety. If I'm attending Grace Polaris, one of the things that I'm gonna do if I have this big building with all these extra rooms is I'm gonna make sure all the doors are locked when they're not in use, right? Easy peasy. That's one of the things that your insurances would say to do, because we don't wanna create opportunities for more trauma to happen, correct? Correct, right. So it might be helpful to talk with your church about, are we doing everything in terms of just even creating a safe environment? Another opportunity for creating a safe environment might be thinking through people who have experienced significant trauma, or honestly even other sensory related things where a triggering thing might pop up, is having a separate place outside of the sanctuary where they can go and calm down. That would probably have windows and things like that, so that they can have space to re-regulate or feel safe. It might be another place where we might put in trigger warnings. So anytime you have an abrupt change in lighting, not just topics that you talk about, but abrupt change in lighting or sounds, that can be a triggering experience, not just for people with sensory things, but for traumatic things, right? So if I'm in a car wreck, right, that could be traumatic to a kid who's been in a car wreck. And so maybe we avoid doing things, or we give triggering warnings to things like that. That actually hurt. I wasn't ready for that one. Another idea I had was to potentially develop a local partner or care ministry list for referrals and resources. So say you do cover a difficult topic on Sunday. You want to make sure you're prepared with follow through on, okay, if people in the congregation are navigating these things, I have a list of resources and referrals I can give them, because it's not going to be helpful to say, wow, that's hard, where should you go, right? We need to have where they need to go. And you can call the network office, and I am sometimes helpful because I'm usually the one that they call for ideas and resources. And I do have lists around Columbus and Cleveland, but usually if you're in an area I'm not familiar with, I'm going to do a quick Google and try and see, hey, do these guys look faith-based? So it's way more helpful for you with the relational connections you have to potentially already be checking in with either people in your church who do counseling and things like that, or other organizations, or finding them locally. Again, I can help, but you guys are definitely more boots on the ground where I'm doing those general Google searches. So those are just some ideas. The goal is to come alongside and walk alongside. You are not called to be all things to all people, and neither is your church, but it is helpful to partner with other people and have the resources available for them to be served, right? All right. Next one, resist doing further harm. This is where going back to having the policies in place for staff, pastoral staff and volunteers, to make sure that they're taking care of themselves, because sometimes when we're experiencing our vicarious trauma because we are serving, right, it's easy to do. Often church staff are the first responders. So think of a tragic event. Usually the first person they call, even before they call 911, is the pastor, and then they're the one calling. And so recognizing that that often happens, there is higher opportunity for vicarious trauma and burnout. And so one of the things we have to be mindful of is that frequent checking of, again, why is this bothering me this way? Because if I'm not, I'm gonna be operating out of my own pain. Right, because hurt people, so if I'm not taking care of myself and doing those things to protect myself and make sure I have healthy boundaries, I'm gonna be more likely to do unintentional harm to the people I serve. So that's just one way that we practice resisting doing further harm, but other ways we do that is practicing empathetic listening. That's obviously making sure that you're fully listening to the person, being present, not preparing your response to what they're saying, because then you tend to miss what they're saying, right? Avoid things like platitudes, cliches, and judgment. So think, I know in my life, I've heard, God's never gonna give you more than you can bear. right? Or that was God's will. Sure. Sure it was. And this hurts really bad, right? And so just thinking through, sometimes we say those religious platitudes and cliches, and that's more about us than about them, right? It's because we're uncomfortable and we feel like we need to have something to say. Sometimes it's just best to be present and silent. If we don't know what to say, that can be just as powerful because we're still there. And that might be all they need at the time. And sometimes we unintentionally do more harm when we do things like that. Obviously, we already talked about create a safe space. I scared you with my clapping of hands, so give trigger warnings. Providing permission to leave. Some people, especially if they see church as like this religious authority, they don't even feel comfortable getting up during a sermon and going to the bathroom. So giving opportunity ahead of time of, hey, like this is a come and go place. Go to the bathroom if you need, right? Be aware of those power imbalances we talked about. Have the resource list. Be mindful of your own burnout with intentional self-care and reflection. Carefrontation is a big one. I think we go on two swings. We either address the behaviors too much or we let the behavior slide too long. And both of those cause harm, okay? So part of what carefrontation does is recognizes that, again, they're doing their best they can, but sometimes they get stuck in their behaviors because it's working for them. And it's not only impacting their growth, but it's impacting the group, right? So then it's coming alongside and giving those if-thens, right? Of, hey, we need this to stop. You're monopolizing the group. If it doesn't, we're going to have you, you know, sit with us or take a break or whatever it looks like. And it might get to the place where we need to have them take a break from church. Hopefully it doesn't get to that, but sometimes it can, okay? But it needs to happen because we tend to operate in the extremes too. So being mindful that carefrontation needs to happen. The last one is become a protective factor. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But going back to the ACE study, part of what impacts the significance of a trauma that somebody experiences is their protective factors. It's their support systems. And it's also a big thing when it comes to the statistic of suicide in terms of those who have experienced trauma might be more likely. Well, if I'm doing a suicide assessment, one of the first things I ask is, what are your protective factors? And so part of where the church is able to minister most is becoming that, providing opportunities for connection and support and things like that will create more opportunities for that to become a protective factor for the people that you're serving. So it can both prevent or support current traumas, and it can also prevent maybe somebody who's so far deep in their trauma that they want to make a permanent decision based on a temporary emotion. And then the final thing that Karen McClintock talks about in her book is as spiritual leaders, we need to add a fifth R, which is reconnect. And so we talk about how trauma is this break in trust. It's this deep relational wound that breaks us not only with, breaks connection not only with our supports here on earth, but it can sometimes break our trust and connection in God. Because that's where we question, you know, where was he in those moments and things like that. And so the fifth R for the church is to intentionally create opportunities for that reconnection. And we do that by following the model of Jesus. When we look at a lot of his miracles, they had two parts to them. He meets their physical need. He provides healing. But that healing also provided a reconnection, whether it be to the community that they were in, to the family that they had to leave because of leprosy, and things like that, and also a reconnection to him. And so part of where, again, the church is able to most meet the needs and really show the love of the gospel is to provide those opportunity for connection. Those people who feel like they're the outcasts, the aliens, as that one quote said, it's meeting the physical need where they're finding connection within the local church so that they're more willing, more open, and more vulnerable to allow that reconnection to God, and to really hear that as well. So going back to the four R's, we recognize, respond. I missed one. There you go, realize. There we go. And then we reconnect. Did I say all four of them or five of them?
Resist.
We resist doing harm. Don't do harm, guys. Resist doing harm. It's been a long day. The Chick-fil-A is wearing off and the coffee is definitely gone. All right. Any questions? Yes.
I hate to ask.
No, you're good.
Okay. So this is more of a clinical approach to trauma. I guess my question is, do we have anything that bridges between the clinical and the spiritual, like deliverance or dealing with spiritual warfare or anything else, casting demons out? I mean, all of those things appear in Scripture as well. And I'm wondering, since nothing's been said, is there a bridge between this clinical presentation and spiritual aspects of dealing with some of these traumas?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So their question was, is this was obviously a more clinical presentation. Is there some spiritual components to it? Yes. So there is other books that have been written on navigating the spiritual realm in terms of casting out demons and things like that. From the approach of this is a very brief flyover on trauma-informed ministry, it's really the approach of just understanding that everybody coming in may have been impacted by trauma, and these are the steps that we would do to create a system around being trauma informed. So it's not taking steps to what do we do with the trauma other than provide the resources and referrals and obviously pray for them and things like that. This is just more of the what do we do as a church or organization to be more trauma informed and recognize that people coming through the doors are experiencing.
So this is information about identifying trauma rather than having any kind of action steps to deal with
it. Correct, correct. It's a very brief flyover. Yeah, so one of the things that we have to recognize too though is some trauma doesn't need to be cast out, if that makes sense, right? And so then it's sorting through those things. But yes, this is more of a what can we do to make sure our church is not doing further harm by recognizing that most people coming through our doors might have experienced some form of trauma. Yeah, so, yeah.
What I realized too is that, you know, obviously I have kind of constant background, so I'm aware of the past and stuff like that. And sometimes with trauma, you have people that have, you know, demon possession, but through that experience, they physically and in the soul realm experience a lot of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the devil can be cast out, they still have to learn how to deal or heal from the emotional state, not only the spiritual state.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah, that's good. Yeah, good way. Yeah, please.
I think a good way of summarizing what you just shared is, as a church, looking at it instead of what happened to you, like why are you acting like this, versus, or I'm sorry, I did that wrong. Instead
what's of, wrong with you?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Right? It's like what
happened to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, that's very good. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I got a question.
Yeah.
So what have you tried to, like, I personally tried to start like a group at our trauma group at our church. The problem that we have is like people don't seem to, one, don't get it,
mm-hmm.
and two, they don't really see the need for it, and three, like we can't get anybody really to participate in doing it. I mean, they think like, oh, well, this is for bigger churches. This isn't really for a small church.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how to like correspond to them. Like it's for everyone, not bigger churches alone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely really difficult to get things started. I think some encouragement for you, one, is I love it because having any opportunity where somebody can just come and be met where they're at is really, 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 really helpful. I think some of the other things that you might be running into that I've seen is sometimes people have minimized their trauma so much that they don't even recognize that they've experienced it. And honestly, as a counselor, you feel like you're beating your head against the wall, and then all of a sudden they've disclosed something like months in, and I'm like, that would have been really helpful to know a long time ago. And they're like, oh, I didn't think it was a big deal, right? So sometimes they've minimized it so much that they don't even know they need it. Sometimes they might be aware they need it, but they're not ready yet. So I would say keep going, keep making those relational connections, because that's your biggest win there. And it might not just be for your church, so hopefully you're opening that up to the rest of your community. That might be helpful too. So, yeah, I love that though.